It's nice to be back in your pulpit. Last time I was here, you were celebrating your 175th anniversary as a congregation. I think they chose me because they felt I had tracked with most of the time the church had been involved, but it is nice to be back. Several years ago, Walter Cronkite stepped out of his role as television commentator to say a word about religion. And Cronkite said, "I think that the greatest test of a person's faith is when a loved one is stricken by a disease or someone very close to you is suddenly stricken down. Even an agnostic," he said, "would wonder what kind of crapshoot was going on." I think that Walter Cronkite was right. Certainly, people of faith find that suffering and disease presents a major problem to their faith, especially when it happens to folks who are good and righteous. And perhaps the greatest struggle we have is that when someone is close and dear to us is suddenly stricken down. I raise all of this because for the last couple of years, I have spent time with a man by the name of J.B. Word. J.B. is a very righteous, very godly man, respected and admired by the people of faith, and also respected and admired in his community. J.B. did wonderfully well in the realm of business. He spent his life in agriculture. He accumulated large tracts of land, had flocks and herds, had all of the things that went with being a business tycoon. He had made it thick and good in the bottom line. His colleagues admired him, and some of them, frankly, envied him. What I admired about J.B. is that he had gotten to the top of his profession and had not sacrificed his principles. He and his wife loved children. In fact, they had 10 of them. Given his income, he was able to provide for them, and he gave them all that they needed. They had a lovely home, a splendid education. But most of all, he brought his children up in an environment of faith. In fact, after they were old enough to leave home and get married and be out on their own, he testified that he and his wife never missed a day praying for his kids. He knew what it was like out there in the secular culture and knew how easily they could be seduced from their faith and from their values. So he was the kind of person that people respected, a good and godly man. A man who is successful in business, but more important, successful in life. But then, all at once, life crumbled in on J.B. First thing that happened is that he lost his business. Didn't happen because he made some blunder in a business decision or even because of the recession. It happened because he was robbed. A group of corporate raiders zeroed in on the three basic areas of his business, and they swooped down upon it when he was not suspecting them. They left him destitute. There was no golden parachute. And, it was a devastating blow. He'd given his life to building up that business, and then suddenly, in a matter of days, it was taken away from him. Something else happened to him. He lost his children. His children, even though there were 10 of them and they were years apart, were always close. And even after they left home, they made excuses for being together. Once, when one of his daughters was having her birthday, all 10 of the children assembled at the home of J.B.'s eldest son. It's in another part of the country. They had a marvelous celebration, and then on the closing day they were together, there was a storm. You may have read about it. A tornado swept across the community. It was almost as though it had eyes. It came down on JB's eldest son's home. The whole building crumbled and all 10 children were killed. It was an overwhelming loss. The people in the insurance company said it was an act of God. It seemed like men and God had come together to strip JB of everything that he held precious. And yet he didn't deny his faith. Somehow he managed to maintain a testimony of his vital trust in God. And then something else happened. He lost his health. He was afflicted by a disease, a strange disease that covered him with boils from the soles of his feet to the roots of his hair. Those of you who are in counseling can probably understand it. Holmes and Ray have put together that stress chart. They have assigned to crisis experiences in our lives certain number of points. The death of a mate, the divorce, a major move. Each one, so many points, and if you get over 100 points, the chances are excellent that within 6 months, you'll come down with a disease or sickness. So evidently, what was going on in JB's life inwardly was a bit different than what he was talking about outwardly. Evidently, the stress took out its pain on his body. It was the kind of disease that left him crippled. He couldn't stand. He couldn't walk. He couldn't lie down without being in excruciating torture. His wife watched him suffer, and one day she saw him suffer so badly and so intently that she suggested that it might be wise for him to take his life. She didn't really believe in suicide, but as she looked at her husband, she recognized that death would be better than living this way. The pain seemed to be unceasing. JB would have none of it. In fact, I guess because of the pain, he lashed out at his wife, told her what she said was stupid, that it was ungodly, it was unworthy of her. He did not want her to speak about it again. Only God had the right to blow the final whistle on life. He'd leave it to him. One thing JB did have was a network of friends, of fellows he grew up with who shared his faith, shared his life. Oh, they had moved away, but they still kept contact. When those friends heard that JB was going through this torture, they decided to come to be with him. They actually closed their businesses and crossed the miles, and they wanted to be by his side. They couldn't do much to alleviate the pain, but they wanted to go through the experience with him. In fact, they divided up the day into equal periods, and one of them would stay with him day and night. If he wanted to talk, they'd talk. If he wanted to be quiet, they would be quiet. You've got to admire that. Sometimes the best thing we can give to another person going through a deep, difficult time is just our presence. Sometimes to quote a Bible verse or lay on another person a religious platitude is more demonic than it is angelic. They just wanted to be there for him. And they did. Days passed. And then I think JB ran out of inner time. I have a friend, a psychologist, who says that the thing that puts us over the brink is pain plus running out of inner time. You know what inner time is. You break your arm and you go to the physician and he sets it and says, look, it's going to be in a sling for 6 or 7 weeks, but It's going to get better. You'll be all right again. So you don't like to have your arm in a sling. It's frustrating, but you can handle it. I mean, you can knock off in your mind 6-7 weeks, but if it becomes 2 months or 3 months or 4 months and the arm still isn't healed, you begin to run out of inner time. You're not only sick, but you're sick and tired and disgusted. And evidently, that's what happened to JB because he lost it. One day, he just exploded. He said he wished he'd never been born. He thought that God had made a terrible mistake bringing him into the world, and if God knew he was going to suffer like this, it was more than a mistake. It's a kind of cruelty. He resented it. Friends didn't quite know what to do with it. They wanted to be there to hold him up, but they were religious men. They didn't want to let God down. They felt that somehow with this outburst, something that they had never heard J.B. do before, a kind of denial of his faith, they felt, that somehow they had to say something and be on behalf of God. So one of them suggested that maybe God was trying to teach J.B. a lesson. There's some lessons we only learn in the schoolroom of suffering, and maybe when he got that lesson learned, and he'd be able to come back to health again. J.B. wasn't buying into that. God wanted to teach him some kind of lesson, and let God teach him the lesson. Put it up on a blackboard where he could read it, where he could see it. What's the point of playing games? Point. Who's got the point? If God wants to get the point across, let him tell him. Friends didn't know quite how to handle that outburst. Here was a man that they had turned to as a paragon of faith, trust. They began to suspect that there might be something going on in JB's life. After all, it's possible for people to look very righteous when they're in the spotlight, but boy, in the dark recesses of life, they might be something else. After all, who ever suffered being innocent? So they began to probe. They began to say that maybe there was something in his life that God wanted to deal with, God had to deal with, that God would not overlook in a religious person what he would condemn unbelievers for. And they pushed and they probed and they said that there must be something wrong. J.B. was furious. Wasn't perfect, he knew that, but he wasn't an unrighteous man. He had been kind to his neighbors. He had been good to his family. He helped those who were in need. He knew of nothing in his life that would deserve the loss of a business, the loss of his family, the loss of his health, an estrangement from his wife. He wasn't buying into that. And he, what is more, would not confess to something that he did not believe to be true. And if God had something against him, let God tell him. And if God told him, he said he would feel free to speak to God about it because he wouldn't buy into it, even if God told him. Then he turned on his friends. He told them he thought they were theological kooks and the best thing they could do was just to keep their mouths shut. He didn't need to hear any more of this kind of religious drivel. But they didn't keep their mouths shut. They couldn't. They kept saying there must be something wrong. Something desperately wrong. So that's what happened in the life of J.B. Work. Lost his business and his children, his health. There was a distance between himself and his wife. In the course of everything, he'd lost his friends. As I tried to think about all of that, tried to unpack it, came to some conclusions. One conclusion I came to is that sometimes we say that ignorance is bliss. Came to realize that's absolute stupidity. You know, what you don't know won't hurt you. Boy, what you don't know can devastate you. If you watch television, and I'm sure most of you do, you have probably watched Matlock. Ben Matlock is portrayed by Andy Griffin. He's a defense attorney in the city of Atlanta. Last year, there was a program, and when it started in, there were two men who had committed a murder. And they had arranged things so that Matlock would be framed for killing a man. One of the two men who had committed the murder had a brother in the penitentiary, and Matlock had put him there. And this was his way of getting back at Matlock. He'd be arrested, found guilty, and the wheels of the criminal justice system would grind on, and he'd be in the penitentiary and maybe even be executed. Everything pointed to Matlock. Then they ran the credits, they had the commercial. When we got into the program again, Ben Matlock had been arrested. In fact, he'd been accused of the crime. All of the evidence pointed to him. He didn't have an alibi. And he didn't have a ghost of an idea what had happened to him. Now, we knew, those of us who were watching the program, we had seen the opening. But he didn't. So we sat and watched as Ben Matlock tried to unravel what had occurred. And the tension of the program was to see him deal with something he didn't understand, try to make sense of it. This story I told you about J.B. Work, well, J.B. Work is a synonym or a pseudonym. Because what I was really telling you is the story of a man in the Old Testament, a man by the name of Job. What happened to J.B. Work happened to Job. The opening verse of the book of Job says that in the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. We don't know where Uz was. We don't know where the book of Job took place. We don't know when it took place. And that may be deliberate. The biblical writer may have put it beyond time and put it beyond place because what he is dealing with is a universal problem. The question of why righteous people suffer. How you can handle it. How you can respond to it. As you read the opening chapter of Job, it says in verse 6 that one day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" And Satan answered, "Well, from roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." And then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He is a blameless and upright person, a man who fears God and shuns evil." And Satan, in this encounter with God before the angelic host, asks the question. It's a demonic, devilish question. The question attacks God's wisdom and demeans Job's integrity. With a single question, he makes God out to be a fool and Job out to be a fraud. Because Satan says, "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Haven't you put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? What Satan has said is that Job is righteous because he knows it pays. Job is into you because of what he can get out of you. You take away the hedge. You take away the things he treasures and values. And you'll see, he'll just turn around and he'll curse you to your face. Very clever question. In asking that question, Satan is putting a tremendous gap between God and the people. If Job, the most righteous man on earth, is serving God simply because of self-benefit and nothing else, then it will never be possible for God to have anything to do with human beings, because if the most righteous man on earth is in his righteousness utterly selfish, then good becomes evil and righteousness becomes a deep sin. Oh, it was a clever question. And so God lays his character and Job's integrity on the line and says to Satan, you can touch him. Can't take his life, but you can do everything else. And that's where we meet Job, like we met Ben Matlock. We read the first two chapters and we discover that God and Satan are having at it over this righteous man. There are critics who, when they read the book of Job and read the Hebrew of the book, say that the first two chapters don't have anything to do with the rest of the book. Because the first two chapters are, admittedly, very rough Hebrew, and from chapter 3 on, it's very smooth, poetic Hebrew. They say the first two chapters were added sometime later on. I think they're wrong. I think they are dead wrong. If you read the book of Job and start in chapter 3 and go to the end, all you've got are five men sitting around talking about suffering, and they're getting no place. If you ask what the book of Job is about, it's really not about suffering. The book of Job is basically about faith, about believing, even though we don't understand. You and I read the first two chapters. We know what is taking place. We know about this battle in the heavens. And I think as we come to the rest of the book of Job out of that, we don't take the book too seriously. We sort of flip through to the end to see whether or not God won his bet or not. Did Job curse God or did he not? I don't think we feel the agony. I don't think we hear the anger. I don't think we sense how close Job comes to blasphemy. I don't think we realize the tremendous tension this man is under as he tries to struggle with pain and loss he does not understand, and he refuses to confess sin that he does not know about. Well, I don't think you can understand the book unless you know that Job is dealing with things happening in his life that he doesn't know anything about. And when you come to the end of the book, you discover that God speaks to Job. Finally, after all of these chapters of pain, God speaks to Job. What is interesting is that when God speaks to Job, he doesn't answer any of his questions. I mean, for 36 chapters, all you've got are questions and questions and questions and questions. God doesn't even bother with them, doesn't say a word about them. In fact, the only thing that God faults Job for is that he's ignorant. God sounds at the end of the book like a teacher who has a student who hasn't done the assignments, and he wants to embarrass him, to show him he just hadn't studied. You know, a teacher can do that. Just ask a bunch of questions. I don't know. Another question. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. So God does with Job. I said to Job, Job, were you there when I created the universe? No. Job, were you there when I created the wind? No. Job, were you there when I made the alligator and the hippopotamus? No. Job, would it ever have occurred to you to make an alligator and a hippopotamus? No. Oh. Doesn't fault him because of his faith. Doesn't fault him because of his dedication. Just his ignorance. God is saying, Job, if you don't know how I created the world, then you better step down off of your soapbox if you're trying to be angry about the way I'm running the world. No. All God faults him for is his ignorance. As you and I read the book of Job, we know what he didn't know. We know what he never knew. I suspect that if you didn't read the first two chapters of Job and you just started in at chapter 3, you might decide that Job was an evil man. You might wonder how in the world he could be called an example of patience. You might even end up agreeing with Job's four friends, if all you had is chapter 3 on. But Job is an example of a man or a woman of faith who believes even though they don't understand, because God ultimately won his wager with Job. Job questioned God's goodness, he questioned God's wisdom, he questioned God's dealings, but he always questioned God. God was always there, and Job wasn't too polite about the way he asked the questions. Didn't just lie down there and be a sweet saint. No, he took God seriously enough to argue with him. And in it all, he never cursed God, never denied him. There are times in which that is what faith is all about. You go through experiences you do not understand, and others go through experiences they cannot explain. Now, of course, there are times in which you go through tough experiences and God teaches you lessons of life you need to learn. And sometimes we go through difficult times that we brought on ourselves because we have disobeyed God, done our own thing, gone our own way. We suffer the consequences. But there are other times in which none of those explanations work. There are things going on you don't understand. But in your ignorance, you simply trust God. There's one other thing that I find interesting in the book of Job. When Job was out there on center stage all by himself, I mean, he lost everything. His business, his children taken from him. As he was sitting out there suffering, his wife walked away from him. She couldn't stand to look at him anymore. His friends went off the stage, and he just sits there alone and suffers. What he could not see beyond the footlights was that there was an audience watching him. God and Satan, angels and demons. They were sitting on the edge of their seats. Their mouths were dry. Their hands were tight, wondering if this man in his suffering would ultimately deny God. In the moment he thought he was most alone, he was being watched by an audience of eternal beings. That what he was going through all by himself had cosmic significance. And when he thought he was most alone there in that patch of land called Uz, he was the center of a drama in the theater of the universe. And that God had staked his integrity on a man called Job. And Job never knew that. But with the edges of his fingernails, he held on to God. That's something to think about.